the greatest engine of all time? We'll discuss that and other issues tonight on Autoline After Hours.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 196, May 17th, 2013, Little Big Block.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Well, welcome, everybody. It's another scintillating episode of Autoline After Hours. My co-pilot, John, is thrashing some Kias somewhere, and so I'm hosting tonight's show with my good friend Gary Vasilash from Autoline Automotive Design and Production and Auto Field Guide, and we'll be joined by Scott Burgess when he gets out of the traffic jam he's in. Scott's from Motor Trend. And coming up, we have a very special guest, Jordan Lee, the Global Chief Engineer and Program Manager for Small Block Engines at General Motors. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing good. So I was just where yesterday I was where John is today.
Driving the Cadenza that you can't talk about?
I think we can talk about it. So it's basically the Kia version of the Hyundai Azera.
Right. But for some reason... at the auto show in Detroit, it didn't look as substantial as the Hyundai. You know, it's really weird at the auto shows. I say this a lot, but when you see these cars under the lights and then you see them out in the flesh in the real world, it's a totally different thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's visually, they're entirely two different cars.
Right.
The Azera strikes me as being... much sportier, and this is sort of the senior sedan for the lineup for Kia, because you realize that Hyundai has Genesis on top of Azera and then Equus on top of Genesis,
right?
And at this point anyway, that Cadenza is their top of the line, and they were just basically saying that people who are going in and loading up their Optimas get to the point where, you know, there's nothing else to add, and they're saying, well, we want to go higher. So that's the rationalization for this vehicle.
I see, but it's not a very memorable name, if I were to.
Well, apparently it's all in keeping with their musical theme. So, Cadenza, Optima,
yeah,
and so on. So, but, man.
Yeah. So, what are you driving this week? Anything good?
Well, I just got out of a Infiniti FX, which... will become a Q of some sort or another, QX, I suppose.
Yes, QX. Yeah. And,
it's an interesting car from a design point of view. I mean, you have these voluptuous curves on that thing. You have an SUV that looks unlike any other SUV on the planet, arguably, perhaps even in the known universe.
But the interior packaging suffers for it, right?
In terms of, but let's be realistic. I mean, how many people buy SUVs truly
and really use them for what they were intended
for interior packaging? I mean, right. they all, you know, even the full size ones. I mean, you look at it and say, okay, this is the cargo room. Well, yeah, you put that seat down, you'll have that room. But wait a minute, I need that seat. No, you don't. And but it just you know, if you want something that stands out, then that's the sort of vehicle that you really need to get. And it had good performance and. Quilted seats, quilted leather seats.
Yeah, it's borrowed from Bentley, but I'm not so sure it translates into.
Yeah, but how many people have seen the interiors of Bentleys, right?
That's true.
So
it was interesting. Johan announced at Infiniti there's going to be a new top line model this week, and also, I mean, obviously, I think they're going to work on a super sports car of some kind. So now I'm driving a Buick Encore.
How's that working out for you?
You know, I'm kind of impressed with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it runs good. It's, the packaging is, you know, unless you have kids the size of E.T., you know, the back seat isn't all that great. I mean, I think it's going to have great appeal for, like, people in their 20s, like mid-late 20s who are, you know, need to be able to throw stuff in the back. But still, I don't know. I've just driven it for a little bit, but I like it.
So have you seen the ads with the dinosaurs?
Yeah, I'm not liking that. But
no?
I like the car. So let's see. While we're waiting for Scott, what can we talk about? Porsche unveiled the 918 Spyder with the official pictures and a long press release. There it is on the screen.
It's hybrid powertrain system.
A long press release and about the six. I lost track of the modes you could dial in with the thing. You know, the actual V8 engine doesn't have that much power, but
right.
You add the electric stuff to it, and it's got 800 some horsepower. But the thing that, you know, I'm reading all that, and it sounds good, and this and that, and it's all carbon fiber, this and that. And then they let slide at some point what the weight was, which was 3,750 pounds. Wow, there's a lot of stuff jammed in there. Yeah, but man, that's, you know. So it'll be interesting. I mean, it does have the exhaust coming out the top of the rear of the car, which apparently makes it sound awesome, which I believe. So I thought that was pretty radical. I mean, it's the only production car in the world that does that. So it's going to be interesting. They say they have a lot of learnings going on as they prepare for their entry back at Le Mans in 2014. So, and I'm hearing that racing car is quite radical. So that'll be interesting.
Well, speaking of German builders, I was reading the address that Dr. Norbert Reithofer, chairman of the board of management of BMW,
made this week.
I hope
week.
You're saying what I think you're saying.
Well, no, I just want to ask you about something. There are several things in here, but I thought I thought of you particularly when I read this passage here, and he's talking about premium brands and what premium brands mean, and he says people know and sense that our premium brands represent a promise of exceptional product substance, of innovative technologies, of future-oriented design. Now, I was thinking, okay, so what does Peter think about that as a descriptor of what a premium brand would be?
I think it's pretty good, but then on the other hand, he went on to say that the Germans are the
angst.
Yeah, he made some comment about the German mindset and that they need to embrace electric vehicles. And it was just like, whoa.
Yeah, we believe in electromobility and are putting it on the road. Germany's respected and admired the world over for its engineering expertise and powers of innovation. But German angst is also a concept the rest of the world is familiar with. German angst refers to how, when it comes to making radical changes, we in this country like to engage in long and fearful discussions because we Germans tend to see more problems than opportunities, and it is no different with electromobility.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty radical. So you don't hear that every day from a CEO.
No, I mean, in fact, he not only busted out with that, but he also went after the politicians, after the EU for changing the targets for CO2. So he was
they're in danger of really going off the reservation over there. So, you know, I don't think his branding thing was too far off. That was pretty good. And another German manufacturer made news with the Mercedes showing their new S-Class, which is another German technological wonder, which it's damn near drives itself. If you read there's so much technology and electronic magic in it that I don't know.
So when does that go a bridge too far?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they're dancing on the edge there. But Old Uncle Dieter needs the S-Class to be a huge success, because that is their, this is it for them. It has to be great.
But does it have to be great for purposes of its reputation as an engineering leader, or does it have to be superb because they need to sell some cars?
Yes. Both. Yeah. Has to be both. So let's change subjects now. This news came across the wires. The total miles per capita driven has fallen every year since 2004, thus ending a driving boom that dates back to 1964. What do you think of that?
I think gas prices are taking a toll on people doing driving. I mean, I'm sure when we were growing up, that every Friday and Saturday night we spent an inordinate amount of time going up and down Telegraph, and
or Woodward, in the case, maybe.
Yeah, and West Side or East Side, and you know, and so think about that. I mean, do you honestly believe that a whole lot of kids, and when we were kids, do that anymore?
No,
and therefore, you know, all those miles are no longer being racked up. The other thing, though, you have to think about is what are the you know, ramifications of people traveling by air?
Yeah.
You know, that's become more accessible, Mr. Burgess.
Mr. Burgess, let's sit here. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, wrong way.
How are you?
Good.
Good to see you.
I apologize, Gary.
That's all right. I know that 696 traffic is bad.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Scott Burgess from Motor Trend.
You guys were talking Benghazi.
Yeah.
How'd you know?
No, we were talking about the IRS. No. Actually, we were talking about how the total miles per capita has dropped, and it's been the end of the boom that started in 1964. And, you know, Gary made points. I mean, we just aren't driving the way we used to. Price of fuel.
Remember all that time you wasted behind the wheel going up and down whatever street it was that you went up and down on Friday and Saturday
nights? Oh, cruising, yeah. Nobody does that anymore.
No. That's what we're figuring. I mean, what would the...
And then the end of regular radio in cars. You know, it's almost... And, I wrote about that on the site a little bit. It's just, I get it. Satellite radio is better. You know, everyone... Or you plug in your thing and it's better. But there was something about radio when you were wandering around late at night trying to stay awake, and you were in a strange area and you'd keep tuning that dial, and, you know, it was part of the American experience. Now it's just, you know, gone.
Well, another part of that, though, is, I mean, think about the old days of cruising, and if you were listening to the radio, you're listening to CKLW or what you were listening to, and it was just basically, it was talking to you.
Yeah.
Okay, because it was you know, some local guy was talking about the local scene versus some guy who's sitting in a studio in Washington, D.C. or New York City or wherever he is broadcasting to the, you know, to the Sirius XM audience.
And I heard from an old ad colleague, Jim Zinser. Jim and I used to work together at Darcy on Pontiac, and he's an ex-announcer. And he just said, yeah, you know, I won't miss it. I like my satellite, and I don't care. But there was just something about it. I mean, but that's getting back to the driving thing. That's when you'd kind of get in the car and say, I want to go to Sioux City, Iowa today.
Right.
And you'd do it. Now, I mean, a lot of young people, I shouldn't generalize. Some young people just don't get the driving thing at all.
Well, people don't even get their license right away. I mean, a sign of independence of a teenager used to be based upon getting your driver's license, and now, that's no longer the case.
No, now it's when they're issued their phone at 7.
Or three,
or whatever, and they're adept at it, too.
I guess we do sound like a bunch of old men, though. Get out of my yard!
Yeah, no, I don't want to sound like that. I mean, it's different time, different era. I still think when people start making money and have a real job, they understand that, you know, I do need to do stuff.
Well,
I
think
it's to get a vehicle of some kind.
Well, except for the fact that now they have those giant college debts they have to pay off.
Well, no, I think it's also tied to the fact that the population has changed, that more than 50% of the population is living in cities now, and cities are cars kind of a hassle.
Yeah. And they're expensive.
So you'll see Zip cars or, you know, communal cars, or
MetroCard just announced its 21st major metro installation, Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Detroit's getting a train. Come on, 3 miles of track right down Woodward.
Yeah.
Supplement the people mover, huh?
Yeah.
I can hardly wait to come. So how about the NTSB's new alcohol limit recommendation?
Point stupid.
Yes, I agree. I'm not going to be politically correct on this. Of course, I never am. But, I mean, what the hell? It reminds me of a routine that Chris Rock did, one of his comedy things on HBO. And it was about how when he was a kid, his mother, you know, said, well, you can play at so-and-so's friend's house down the block. And then something bad happened. And then she said, well, you got to stay in our yard, but you can have friends over. Then something bad happened. And then by the time she was done, he was standing in place outside the kitchen window so she could see him. And it was funny. It was much funnier when he said it, but he said, I'm a hopping, Mom. But, I mean, I don't know where it's supposed to stop. I really don't. I mean, Oakland County has two female hanging judges that will throw people in jail for first offenses for 30 days. And, you know, I wonder where the revenue generation, or where the, you know, the lesson, the social lesson ends and the revenue generation starts. And frankly, I think it's all about revenue generation. Is drunk driving bad? Of course it is. But, I mean, you're going to tell people that when they go out, they can have no more than one drink? Because that's pretty much at 0.05. If you have 1.5 drinks, you're right there.
Well, it to me, if they've done all these different tests and they found that if a person with 0.05 BAC is, their reactions are not slowed, it should be science. It should not be, yeah, we just want to lower this because we want to lower it. And
because the other countries are doing it.
Yeah.
There.
They do lots of stuff that we don't need to do.
Yeah, it's annoying. It's very. Gary, you had a couple of things. What about this GM deal to buy vans from Nissan?
Yeah, I was very surprised to see that, the NV2000 vans.
I was too. I mean, are they that threatened by Ford, what they're doing, that they had to react?
Well, what surprises me even more is that why haven't they been working on their own? I mean, it seems strange that they wouldn't have. I mean, commercial truck business is non-trivial. I mean, and Ford has long dominated that space. I think they have like as much as 25% of the entire market just themselves.
Yeah.
And why haven't they been working on it? And then the other, you know, it begs the other question is, okay, If we're seeing this relationship, is this the start of something bigger?
Yeah, you never know.
The Volt Leaf.
And then you also want to talk about Chinese creating new auto niche within Detroit. A lot of Chinese companies moving here.
Yeah, it was an interesting story earlier this week in the New York Times that was basically saying that there are a number of Chinese automotive suppliers moving to the Metro Detroit area, and unlike how it was in past years when there were other, you know, companies coming in from Japan where they would, you know, have certain high visibility, that these guys are just, you know, staying low and trying to get the orders and trying to do what they can, and rather than having, you know, just all the sourcing being done from afar to get direct contracts with the OEMs, and apparently there was a breakthrough with one for engine mounts for the ATS.
Wow. And I know that in Birmingham, SAIC has a huge, their U.S. headquarters, mm-hmm, beachhead, and, you know, it's just...
Is there a supplier that doesn't have an office in Detroit? I mean, everybody does.
Possibly.
Well, there's probably still some guy who's making stuff in his basement and selling him, so, which is, I applaud. And then the rumors that Chrysler is, or Fiesler, as I like to call him, is, I figured this out about 18 months ago, but they're going to have the headquarters for the whole thing in Auburn Hills. I mean, they are in such bad shape in Europe, and this is where the money is, that the plan is to source the headquarters in Auburn Hills.
So will you drop the Assler part of that? Or however one would,
no,
however one would pronounce that.
Assler. No, I think Fiassler is good, but...
So what will be on the building? Will there be a pentastar or not?
Oh, that's a good question. And we're referring to the...
pentastar.
Yeah, we're referring to Chrysler's headquarters out in Auburn Hills, which was custom designed for them. And there's a huge pentastar facing west to the major thoroughfare there, I-75. And I don't know. Maybe they could put the Fiat shield up there, but do they put it on top or below or next to it? I don't know. We don't have to solve that tonight. Let's see. What else? What are you driving, or what have you driven of late that you liked? Or
A GL, Mercedes GL.
Oh, yeah?
The diesel, the BlueTEC. And
what did you think of that?
It's a really impressive machine. It's the thing that is, one is how quiet the engine is.
And how expensive it is?
It's a little pricey.
What is it, like 80-some thousand?
I'm not sure offhand what it is, but... The one thing I would never get is the white interior. It's the white leather interior.
It's just so unpractical.
But overall, I mean, it's a great ride.
Now, is that's about the size of a Q7?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Three rows.
So.
Well, it's interesting what they're doing with the GLK 250 BlueTEC, pricing it below the... GLK 350, which is a V6 3.5 liter gasoline engine. So you actually get the diesel for less than the price of the V6. Now, the horsepower of the V6 is much greater.
Yeah.
But the torque number is, you know, much higher for the
I love diesel. The torque on that thing. I mean, it's just got all kinds of guts.
Yeah.
But... You know, unfortunately, I think diesels are never, ever going to... I would love for diesels to come to America, and I don't think they're ever going to be here in any large number. I can tell myself that it should be. The car guy in me says we should all have diesels and we should probably all have manuals, and I'm wrong there, too. And, you know, and you drive these great diesel cars, and you're like, look, we could have this.
Yeah.
And we're never, ever going to get it. It's never going to pick up in any large numbers.
I think people look at the diesel pump and the diesel handle and the whole thing and say, I really don't want to do that. So, hey, Ben, I think now's a good time to hear from our friends at Bridgestone, and we'll bring our special guest up. And I'm happy to welcome Mr. Jordan Lee, who's the Global Chief Engineer and Program Manager for Small Block Engines at GM. And the teaser for the show said, is this the greatest engine of all time? And
of course it is.
Welcome, Jordan. And he brought a giant visual aid, which we're very happy to reveal the next-gen Corvette. This is the power, the LT1 6.2 liter V8. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful engine. How much horsepower is this, Jordan?
Well, our targets are 450, 450.
Oh, yeah, we haven't announced it yet, right?
We haven't announced it, but we finished our SAE rating last week. And we have a history of exceeding our targets. I don't think we'll break that history, but I'm not allowed to announce yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much do you think you'll break it by?
a measurable amount.
So I'm happy to welcome Jordan here because I often write about the true believers in this business, the people really... You know, they're working it every day. Jordan, in case you're wondering what a true believer looks like, he's the real deal. He gets to play with these engines all the time. He has a talented team that works for him. Mm-hmm. And he's been with GM since 1982.
Right.
So what do you want to talk about? Do you think it's the greatest engine of all time?
I definitely do.
So
I know what's the greatest engine
is this
of all time.
What generation is this?
This is Gen 5, our fifth generation. Very significant redesign relative to Gen 4. Very few common parts. We did a little display for the media in October when I had the carryover parts in a lunch baggie. It was the piston pin, circlips, and some valve retainer keepers, and that was pretty much it. But thoroughly re-engineered.
And what was it, 100 million? Or what was the number of small blocks that have been
over
100
sold?
Yeah, just celebrated an anniversary.
Yeah, it didn't.
100 million
last year.
2012?
12. Now, for historical reference, please add, Gary, if you have anything, but this is the small block Chevrolet was originally developed, designed by Ed Cole mm-hmm. and a couple other guys.
Right. Yeah.
And it debuted in the 55 Chevy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it just went on to become not only a mainstream engine for General Motors and Chevrolet, but one of the great hot rod motors of all time. And Ben, we even have a sound effect of a very healthy small block Chevy and a McLaren Can-Am car. Can we run that? Some stuff. That's Jim Pace and the Predator Performance prepared ex-Oscar Kowalewski McLaren M6 at the greatest racetrack in the U.S., Road America. Mm. And, you know, Jordan, you work on these engines. You've been in and around them, but I don't think that sound gets old for you.
It doesn't. There's just something about a V8 sound
that
is very pleasing to the human being, the human body. It just... the frequency of it, even with a 90-degree crank, it's that that thrum of ground-pounding torque and power. It just puts a smile on my face every time I hear
so
it.
So for the people that don't know, could you explain the nomenclature small block? I mean, because I think that some people might think, gee, they've been making this engine since 1955.
And it's like, still small?
It's like, wow, don't they realize that time has marched on since 1955?
Yeah.
So, you know, tell us a little bit about the small block.
Really became the name when we introduced another V8, which was the bigger block, the big block. It's now out of production. But it wasn't known as a small block up until the time they had to differentiate the two. And yeah, today's relative terms, it's definitely anything but small. But the name stuck. It's been an informal name that we had internally to GM. It became very popular externally, and there's a huge following. And even though we don't really push and advertise, everybody knows and loves small block. And another really cool thing about it, it's a 58-year unbroken lineage for an engine. I don't think there's any other manufacturer that's had an engine in their family, in their lineup for that long. And each new generation, it evolves, and it becomes more current for the things that are important. Like for today, power and torque is extremely important. We have more refinement, and the fuel efficiency is exceptional with a new generation of small blocks. So we're really proud of it. It's something we love. It's very, very important to GM. And the fact that we're able to constantly re-engineer it and keep it current and modern, and it keeps the same form and the name, it's something we're really proud of.
So it's architecturally similar to what,
architecturally similar,
what had been in the past. So that's why it's still a small block, even though the block is now a big block.
Yeah, in relative terms. One of the things that hasn't changed over the years is the bore centers. The spacing between cylinder bores has been 4.4 inches from day one.
So the original motor engine, because every time I say motors, oh, that's an electric thing, don't talk like that. So the original engine was 283 cubic inches, correct?
265.
265, right. And then it was quickly boosted up to 283. But 265. And now, so this is everything GM knows so far in an engine is this engine.
Pretty much.
Represents...
Every now and then we get the chance to an all-new engine. And we get to apply all the things we've learned over the years. We have better analysis tools. You know, the industry changes. The analysis capability gets better. And when you get a chance to do an all-new design and re-engineer it, it's very exciting because you do get a chance to make it your best. We feel this is our best combustion system that we've ever developed in General Motors. And to give you an idea, all the computational time that we spend.
Yeah, we're showing it on screen right now. Go ahead.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
All the computational time, the structural analysis, the thermal, and the combustion, the total 10 million hours, which is a tremendous amount of computational CPU time. 6 million of those hours, literally 60%, were spent just on the combustion system. We went through over 100 iterations of different configurations to get the one that was just perfect, that gave us the ability to raise the compression ratio. This engine has an 11.5 compression ratio. It can run on regular fuel all day.
That's amazing.
And by virtue of that and having a really refined combustion system, you can make a lot of power and a lot of torque as you're using every drop of fuel and you're converting it to energy.
So can that can the learnings from that computation then be used in other engines, other designs of I guess the heads would be the big thing.
Yeah, or even our next generation engines for V6s and four cylinders. We learn a lot. We develop new technical capabilities. They evolve just by the fact of doing.
Well, your next V6 is a four-cylinder as well, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, the Gen 5. We have a lineup for trucks. We have a 4.3 V6 that runs in four-cylinder mode because it has active fuel management. The 5.3 liter and the 6.2 for the trucks, and then the 6.2 for the car. And they share a lot of the common hardware. Another thing that we really boast about is we have a lot of technology on the engine. Direct injection, active fuel management, cam phasing, very sophisticated lubrication system. And we put them on every one of our engines. You don't have to pay extra. You don't have to select an option box to get those technologies. We offer them on every single one, from the base 4.3 liter and the Chevy Silverado to Corvette engine LT1. They all have those technologies.
So the 6.2 is in you mentioned the three engines, mm-hmm. And they're going in the new 2014 Silverado
and
GMC. So how is that 6.2 like this 6.2, or are they just entirely different?
They're not entirely different. They do share a lot of the common structural components, the block, the crank, the cylinder head, the bore spacing. Architecturally, the structural hard parts are they share a lot of the common parts. But the tuning is very different. The lube system is completely different. Intake manifolds, exhaust manifolds, calibration, the oil pan, accessory drives, and all the tuning to get the characteristics that we're looking for. So this one's tuned to make a lot of power. It also makes a lot of torque, which is great for a sports car because coming out of the corners, I mean, the thing pulls really, really hard. I was talking with Tom Reed, who's sitting off screen now, about our latest SAE certified numbers, and we're looking at the torque curve, and at 1,000 RPM, we make nearly as much torque as the base engine, the 911, does at its peak number. At less than 1,000 RPM, we make more torque than the top end of a Cayman. So relative to the Corvette's competition, I mean, the thing, it's pretty much of a monster for a base power plant. Something we're really proud of.
So you rattled off some of the highlights. Is this a aluminum block or cast iron?
Aluminum, yeah.
And direct injection.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, I mean... You're an engine guy. What do you think of the intakes on the outside and the exhausts on the center of the V, like Porsche is doing with their 918?
It's a novel approach.
I know GM had before the bankruptcy, they had a sensational turbo diesel
mm-hmm.
that had that configuration. Yeah. Matter of fact, the engine won an award, and then they had to put it on the shelf.
Mm.
No. What do you think of that? It's just a novel.
I wouldn't say it's really a novelty, but like all automotive companies, we're all slaves to packaging. We have to make the engine fit in the engine compartment. And at times you have to make decisions. If the turbos aren't going to fit on the outboard of the engine, you got to put them on the inside. But the engine will get taller as a result. There are some advantages putting the turbos in the valley. You do have short exhaust runners, so you can spool up the turbos more quickly. And the way you can split the pulses between bank to bank and give you a little better response as well. But packaging drives a lot of the decisions. And that's one of the reasons why the LT1 is, I think, it's really remarkable. And a lot of people agree because it really is small. It's very power dense. And at times we've been asked questions, well, why aren't you double overhead cam? Why aren't you twin turbo like your competition? And we did a comparison to a BMW twin turbo 4.4 liter V8. And their power and torque is similar to ours. We actually make more torque and a little bit more power. But they're a much bigger engine. The engine weighs 40 pounds more. It's 4 inches taller in height. It wouldn't fit under the hood of a Corvette. And if the Corvette had to have a 4-inch taller hood, it's not going to be the same car that we want it to be. So the small block in its architecture allows us to have very compact, very power-dense package and makes the Corvette really what it is today.
I'm glad you brought that up because there's always the perennial discussion among enthusiasts, oh, well, you've got push rods, so that's Neanderthal tech, yeah. and they automatically embrace like the import approach. But when you lay out the numbers and the performance and the overall efficiency, why, if it's broke, why mess with it?
Right.
It delivers.
And it's small, and it's compact, and it's really important for a performance car to keep that low hood line. Tad Schuchter, chief engineer for Corvette, he went through a scenario. Well, say I did have a twin turbo V8 and I raised the hood 4 inches taller. Now I got to raise the driver up 4 inches because he's got to see over the hood. The windshield gets taller, the roof gets taller, the center of gravity gets higher, and the car doesn't handle well anymore. So he really relies on us to give him a very compact package to make the...
So is powertrain involved in parallel with the development of the new Corvette?
Oh, yeah, we work hand in hand, yeah.
So
a very integrated team.
So mm-hmm. So they basically told you that this will be the size that you need to fit this engine into. Now go figure out how to get that engine in that package.
Not so much, but very collaborative. Yeah. In order to do a really good job integrating, we got to work together from day one.
Where do you see the next set of efficiencies in an engine? You guys have grabbed all of the easier ones again. And is it going to be heat, thermal management? Is it going to be more of the super perfect ball bearing? Or
yeah. There's still a lot left in the combustion regime.
Mm-hmm.
And this engine touches upon it, and a lot of our competitors do as well. Active fuel management or cylinder deactivation has been a phenomenal technology for fuel economy. We and Chrysler went alone for quite a while. Mercedes had it, they backed out, but now other manufacturers are coming back into AFM. One of them is the Lamborghini and their Aventador, which is kind of ironic, because when you run in deactivation mode and you get rid of the pumping losses, the fuel economy performance is really, really impressive. So we push the envelope to run more AFM in our new trucks. We have AFM now on the Corvette, and it's seamless enough that people aren't going to be, they won't object to it. We don't want to penalize the driver of the car. But the way we do AFM and more alternatives, maybe more AFM time, maybe even more cylinders for deactivation. There's a lot of technologies there that we are really starting to grasp and explore for more fuel economy in the future.
Are these mechanical changes or are these software changes in terms of the active fuel management?
Well, part of it's really both. It's really both.
Yeah, because you use the cam to turn off. What is it when you're in active fuel management? Your valves aren't moving anymore?
Yeah, we actually turn off 4 of the cylinders, 1, 4, and 6, and 7.
The cylinder still moves, the piston
goes up and
sorry.
Down, but the computer tells solenoids that are in the valley underneath the intake manifold to turn off the oil flow to these collapsible lifters that are in our cylinder deactivation cylinders, and they turn off the intake and the exhaust at just the right time. It traps an exhaust charge. It actually acts like a spring, and it helps you recover some of the energy when you're in active fuel management mode. But a lot of the integration effort with the vehicle, the engine mounts, attenuating the vibration, attenuating the noise when you're in four-cylinder mode. The next generation, the Gen 5s going in the new trucks and the car, we're able to run more AFM. And one of the reasons we're able to run a lot more AFM is direct injection. With direct injection and the increased compression rates, we have a lot more torque than the Gen 4 engines. In general, this thing makes 30 to 40 more pounds of torque right off of idle, and the trucks are no different. So that much more torque allows you to run in four-cylinder mode for a lot longer period of time.
And that's why it's a more aggressive system than the previous. Because I just drove the Silverado, mm-hmm. and you know, in the IP, it'll tell you when you're in 4 or 6 yeah. or 4 and 8. And I was surprised at how often yeah. it stayed in the cylinder deactivation mode.
Yeah. So that's consuming all your time right now. Is that correct?
Quite a bit, yeah.
The launch of the new pickup?
The launch, the pickups and the new engines and bringing our new engine plants.
Run by the engines for us again. What are they in the 2014?
For the trucks, we have the 4.3-liter V6. Our RPO is LV3, and it's a 285 horsepower, 305 foot-pound of torque engine. Tremendous amount of low-end torque, I mean, relative to our competition. Ford has a 3.7, and right off of idle, we've got 20 to 40 foot-pounds. And we did that purposely. We want displacement for using the engine for a truck engine, for towing. The mid-engine for the truck is the 5.3-liter L83, 355 horsepower and 383 foot-pounds of torque, and that's on gasoline. We were talking earlier. We didn't actually advertise it, but the engine's E85 capable. On the E85, the power goes from 355 to 380. But the torque goes from 383 to 416 foot-pounds of torque. So for 5 feet, that's a lot of torque. And then the upper-level engine, the performance engine for the trucks, will be the 6.2 L86 that we haven't introduced yet. That introduction's a little later, so we haven't done the SA cert yet.
Okay.
And then the LT1, which is the 6.2 for Corvette, and the new Corvette Stingray.
So the truck engines are for just truck applications. You wouldn't put them in a car.
No.
And this Corvette engine is essentially just for the Corvette for practical purposes.
Yeah. Or is it going to end up in the... No, it's not going to end up in the Z28. That's a different engine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we announced that one already.
Yeah, that's...
But this is our car engine, and then we're introducing it in the Corvette. But the truck engines, we were very conscious in the fact that we designed these engines for trucks. We've got a great high-feature V6, and it has a lot of great attributes. And Ford has a 3.7 that they put in a lot of different vehicles. But we needed a displacement for truck for the base engine, and we went with this 4.3 liter.
And given that you guys sell so many trucks, that it could actually be a company on its very own with, just as,
I think
the General Motors truck company. Yeah. I mean, it's just.
I think that 4.3 is a really good option for people. I mean, towing is still, I think, 7,500 pounds, and it works really well. And if it's one where you are just towing once or twice a year, you got to take your boat up to Traverse City or something.
Yeah.
Why get a car or get the truck that's. Just get one that can do the job instead of getting a lot more truck than you need. Not that you guys wouldn't want to sell.
Well, F3 is pretty good too. We've got a bigger trailer.
That's kind of America, Scott.
Getting more truck than you need, right?
You don't really need it.
Yeah.
And the 6.2, I don't know if you drove the 6.2 in San Antonio. I don't think we had those available.
No, they weren't available.
I was on some test drives in four-cylinder mode. It makes a ton of torque. I was towing an 8,000-pound trailer in four-cylinder mode up a grade.
During your career, in just 31 years, think about how horsepower has changed.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the big engine in 82?
Oh, man. Well, we had I don't know what the RPO for the small block was at the time for Corvette, but they're in the low to mid-200s.
Yeah, 220, 220 horsepower.
Is that the L82 or something?
Well, we had an LT1 in 1992, I believe. 300 horsepower. Yeah. In the mid-80s, it was less.
But you were bragging about that, weren't you?
Yeah.
Damn straight.
Oh, yeah. We love our RPOs, Corvette and small block. We recycle the small block RPOs. They're very historic to us. Yeah. So we're very careful when we select an RPO for a next generation engine.
Will we continue to see that? Where's the top of that curve on horsepower growth?
Well, I hope we haven't seen it yet. I love horsepower. I think everybody does. And the fact that we're able to get such great fuel economy. I mean, you look at SIDI, it's a marvelous technology. It allows us to raise the compression ratio, and the compression ratio is about the only thing that will actually improve your fuel economy and power and torque. They're not mutually exclusive. A lot of other performance things are. You want more power, you're going to give up fuel economy. But this allowed us to get target 450, and still be very fuel efficient.
That's good.
So we expect it to keep going, and we may have. I don't think we've seen the limit yet. I think we can still go.
Do you think CAFE is going to put the kibosh?
Well, you look at the Corvette, for example, and you look at the trucks. I mean, trucks. We sell a lot of trucks, and they really impact CAFE. But
right.
There's always going to be a niche. I think we'll always have a niche, and as long as we're efficient.
Mm-hmm. So before we go to rapid fire, what's the next engine that's high on your list? Has to be the twin turbo V6, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be in the ATS and the XTS?
I can't comment
on
that one because I don't know a lot about the applications. I do know a lot about the small block applications.
Oh, okay.
But maybe you'll get another guest on your show that can talk a lot.
Yeah, just talking about, Well, anyway, GM's got a twin turbo V6. It sounds pretty hot.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben, let's get ready for rapid fire. Let's run that thing. All right, so let's get to it. VRM Chris asks, when will we see a variation of the small block in ALMS and GT3 racing? Where I think he means the new small block. They're working on the new car for the 2014 season, so I don't know what...
Yeah, they're pretty tight-lipped about some of the technologies and when they rolled that stuff out, so I can't
answer. Espo, this is for you, Jordan. On the new 5.3, I've read it uses 0W20 oil. Will that be the only weight you can use?
It's the only weight we recommend, but there are other viscosity choices.
Wow, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's a great efficiency oil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about the oil.
What's the fuel? Is it premium or?
This one actually is premium recommended, but it'll run all day long on regular unleaded.
Is there a drop in horsepower?
There could be, especially if it gets hot. But with SIDI, the combustion chambers stay pretty cold. So you won't notice much of a difference at all.
JB1 asks, what's the red line for the LT1?
6,600.
Yeah. Okay. And then Auburn Speedster says, what is better about the LT1 over the Ford Coyote 5.0 liter V8?
We make a lot more power and torque, and we're probably smaller.
5.7, isn't it?
Yeah, he says 5 liter, but...
Ford has the 5 liter.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 5 liter, the Coyote, I think, was the tag name for the Ford 5 liter.
Yeah, memo to Auburn Speedster, what did you think he was going to say? Okay, let's go on. Stephen Darjo asks, isn't the Chevy City Express a glaring problem of what GM does wrong, but worse, since they are badge engineering a product that they don't even build? Gary? We talked about that.
But it wouldn't even be engineering, though, because, I mean, it's basically a badge, right?
Yeah.
Rebadge.
Adhesive.
And he also says, what's the best miles per gallon you say you'll be able to get in a new Corvette that's not released yet?
Not released yet.
Yeah. 26 is my guess.
Yeah, or more.
What's the current Corvette get?
I think it's around pretty close to that.
Yeah, 28 then.
AM2 asks, if Cadillac is not after volume, why is there a base ATS with a 2.5 liter engine? Is this in response to the less than 3,000 sales numbers of the ATS and XTS last April? Yeah, I don't know what that is. Let's talk about something else. Chuck Grency asks, what are some of the considerations when using cylinder deactivation? Are there wear issues, parasitic drag, et cetera, and how are they dealt with?
Primary issue is integration. It's vibration and noise, and if you do a good job there, then it's transparent to the driver. And Scott can testify. He's tried it in the trucks, and it's pretty transparent.
So meaning when the deactivation happens, you don't go, hmm, yeah. And then when it starts up, you don't go, hmm, and hear all kinds yeah. of funky noises.
Actually, we put
funky noises.
A big V4, V8 on the IP, the instrument panel, because we're bragging about it. It's so transparent. We want people to see, you're really in V4 mode. You probably don't know that. You're doing well in fuel economy.
Hey, Ben, let's run a phone call.
Hi, I have a quick question. Will the LT1 be E85 capable? Will it get more horsepower? And if not, why did you decide not to do E85 for a Corvette engine? A lot of the Corvette guys are retuning the LS3 to run on E85, especially if they do forced induction. And I was just curious if, you know, as a Corvette owner, as a group, we like E85. Could you please consider doing that for the future? Thank you very much.
Well, we could. We didn't on this LT1. Primary reason is the usage wasn't that high. And the development efforts are pretty extensive. And if the usage wasn't there, the decision was made not to make this particular one that capable.
So do you mean in terms of the broad ownership base of yeah. Corvettes tend not to put it E85?
I think in general, the usage overall of E85 has been more than disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, the fuel economy is worse. And the price disparity isn't far enough apart between that and regular gasoline to make economic sense. So we kind of joke about it at work. Sometimes people use E85 once or twice. They'll once to try it. They're not too happy with the fuel economy result sometimes. And if the fuel's not cheap enough, the other time is when they have a rental car and they return to the airport because they will save 40 cents for a gallon of gas, whether it uses it or not.
Hey, doing that from now on.
Yeah. Note to self.
Hey, Ben, let's run another phone call.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. Much has been said how Honda has lost its mojo lately. But what about Nissan? The new Versa and Sentra are mediocre, in my opinion. The Rogue is a bore. The new vans aren't selling well, et cetera. What does the panel think? And what about Gohm's new dictate to the company to try to double their sales in North America within the next 5 years or something like that? Thanks. Bye.
Scott?
I think Honda is actually getting some of its mojo back. I was not all that impressed with the Accord, but the Accord seems to be doing great, and a lot of people really like it. Please. As for Nissan, I don't know if they're losing their mojo. I think that
I thought they were doing pretty well.
The Altima salesman, good. But what Gowen wants is 10% market share.
That's going to be really tough.
But he's getting close. I mean, he's not doing badly on that. So and he wants 10% sustainable market share. He doesn't want we're dealing and put a whole bunch of cash in the back of a Titan. Oh, I have the
he's
wrong
just trying
example.
To distract us from the Leaf.
I do think the Juke is just hideously ugly, and I know a lot of people like it and.
I like it. I like it because it's so, like, OMG. It's so, yeah, it just is.
But, it does perform pretty well.
It's fun to drive.
Yeah, and the best thing about when you're driving it is if you're driving it, you can't see it. You don't actually have to look at it.
Yeah, but at night you have that cool thing, the lights you can see. Yeah. Oh, that man, you think you're driving like Jetson's vehicle. That's what the future is going to look like, Scott.
I want you to know
that's the future.
I think they can get to 10%. The question is, who are they going to take? Whose share are they going to take if Nissan moves up? And... they have a solid midsize car. The Altima is a good car, and it kind of was a changer, showing that you didn't have to have any kind of fancy engine to get to that high gap. What is it, 36 or 38? 38.
Yeah, who's sure they're going to take when Volkswagen is so aggressive, and GM and Ford are so aggressive. I mean,
but if you look at somebody who's really beginning to sputter, it's Volkswagen. We saw that last month in their sales. Mm-hmm. So that's not happening for them. You've got Suzuki's pulled out of the market, right?
So, there's 0.003% share,
right?
Open.
So somebody's going to get that, right?
And it's the old ebb and flow, I guess. Is Kia going to have a version of the Equus?
They seem to indicate no.
Yeah. Okay.
Could have a magic 8-ball. Does not look likely.
Outlook seems foggy.
Mitch W. asks, how long do engineers plan for an engine to last if properly taken care of? How about if it's abused?
Clean oil and keep the oil full, and it should last forever. That's the secret to longevity. A lot of people don't check their oil level, and the oil runs low, and the oil wears out more quickly, and the internal damage occurs then. But if you keep it clean and you keep it full, you shouldn't have any problems.
So how often should you change your oil?
We run up 7,500 miles if you're running a lot of highway driving. We have an oil life monitoring system. If you do a lot of stop and go and the oil never gets up to temperature, it'll indicate to change it sooner than that.
So somebody who's just not this engine, but just an engine, and so they just, drive to work, stop and go, from suburb downtown and caught 3,000 miles?
If it's an older car, an older engine, you can do it twice a year if you're putting less than 15,000 miles on it a year, summer and winter. And if you put a lot more miles, then you're probably still okay, about 6,000 miles.
Hmm.
Okay.
Wright Knight wants me to tell us the small block in a UFO joke, and that was John's. And John said that when the Air Force discovered the UFO in New Mexico.
Roswell,
they found out it was powered by a small block Chevy.
That's a great joke.
That is a good one.
I don't understand why that's a joke.
Yeah,
probably true.
Here's a question. Are we likely to see a compression ignition gasoline engine in production in the USA before 2020? Ray Arand is asking that.
There was some research being done on that a while ago. I haven't heard much about it in the industry as a whole.
You guys were doing a lot of that.
Yeah, every 2 years HCCI. GM does a tour of that, and we...
HCCI.
Right.
But that's a mode. If it's a full-time compression ignition engine, it's not likely.
Yeah. Ramon Rivera asks, in the latest episode of Mad Men, Don Draper's agency won the advertising contract for the XP887, a.k.a. the Chevy Vega. Peter, what's the real story behind the launch of the Vega? How realistic is the advertising pitch process shown in Mad Men? It is realistic to the degree, but I can attest that the real advertising world is much crazier and wild than Mad Men ever portrays. So, and that's true. And as far as the launch of the Vega, I just remember the car and the fact that, interestingly enough, the last years of the big black Chevys in Can-Am and the McLarens, they were running the alloy blocks with no, I mean, it was something in which they put in the Vega.
Wasn't it aluminum on aluminum?
Liners.
It
yes. An aluminum block with apparent bore material of aluminum.
Right.
Right. So yeah. You were getting basically friction welding was going on.
And they did that in the Can-Am cars, and then they did it in the production Vega engine. Mm-hmm. So I had a Vega. It ran fine until it blew up. I blew it up. No, it's like
it wasn't friction welding. You'd wear the bore surface and have oil consumption.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, we got plenty of stuff here.
A couple more calls if you want.
Sure. Let's run a call, Ben.
Very good guest. I have a question. How was it that Chevrolet never went after Ford with their 662? I figured maybe a limited production LS9 HO or something like that to knock down the whole them having the most powerful V8. Just wanted to get some feedback of what was the reasoning they couldn't pull it off. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
He's talking about the GT500
right.
Shelby.
Yeah, the Shelby. Horsepower is interesting. Engineers love to brag about their horsepower. Most customers just want a really fast car. So Porsche, for example. What's the horsepower torque in Porsche? Most people don't know. They just know the cars are fast. Our 580 horsepower Z01 will wipe the track on that GT500. It's faster, and we only need 580 horsepower to do it. So that number's a number. We were putting a lot of our energy in the Gen 5s. And our cars are faster, so I think that's really what matters.
So the power to weight ratio thing is very important.
Power to weight and handling, and I've read a lot of car magazines, and I'm not going to say it was your article, but it's hard for that car to put the power down. It's got a solid axle.
What do you think, Scott?
GT500 can put the power down. You just can't take a corner.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't got that big mass over the front.
Yeah, on the track, you know, you're right.
Yeah.
So as long as you're going straight, you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, and you got to be careful in the morning when the tires are cold because they do a lot of suspension through the tires. And
yeah, you get those horsepower levels over the tires. They make all the difference in the world.
Yeah. It's interesting, that McLaren clip we ran, that car in period lapped Road America. The pole was like 2 minutes and 12 seconds. That car on that lap, which was last summer, did a 206. So you have horsepower, you have tires. Tires
make
huge,
a huge
difference. But it's amazing how fast they were back then. I mean,
ZR1 Corvette, 638 horsepower. I drove one before we had the Pilot Cup tires, and it was like driving on ice. When those tires are cold, man, you gotta respect the gas pedal like you do the brake pedal. You just don't stomp on it or bad things are going to happen. Yeah. And then with the Pilot Cup tires, you could do the most aggressive launch control, and the tires bite. The tires make all the difference. Tire technology is pretty phenomenal these
days. It's huge. Joseph N. asks, how the heck is it that Ford has hit such a home run with the Fusion, yet again the Lincoln MKZ version is not doing so well? This is a recurring problem. Is Ford unable to justify the Lincoln price premium? Actually, the dealers have just gotten the MKZ in any volume, so it's really too soon to know. I mean, the first on the block types have pretty much embraced the MKZ this month and coming into May, so it's just a little premature to make a judgment on the MKZ.
It's a good car.
Well, yeah, Gary thinks it's a fine car. I think they did a great job on it. I think what do you think? You don't.
No, I think that if you want to be a serious luxury brand, you have to have a serious luxury brand platform. And that's the one area.
They need rear-wheel drive.
Either rear-wheel drive or a real solid commitment to the brand. Right now, you're still taking a Fusion and gussying it up.
Yeah, see, but I look at it from the point of view of, at this point, they have something to compete with the Lexus ES. That's what that car is. And,
right.
And it's a credible competitor, and for them to have aspirations that go beyond that, well, then they've got to do that. But, I mean, at this point in time,
I would still buy a Verano over the Lexus ES or the MKZ. I know it's a slightly smaller car, but...
I think...
thank you for that.
I think a lot of enthusiasts who care really won't consider Lincoln being back until they have a.
Yeah, I think that that's the. You just need a car that. You need a platform that. If Lincoln is just a big trim package for Ford, is this the MKZ just the trim level of the Fusion? I'll get the Lincoln trim. Until it's a different car underneath, that's what it is to me.
Well, I think they've got to keep the dealers in business until they come up with something.
And sure,
You need something. And so all I'm saying is that Ford, that's something they have that they'd be able to sell in volume. Because remember that, I mean, Ford Electric.
Yeah, and they do, and I hope it's successful.
Basically made that.
Well, you know, the one thing we have to realize is, I mean, we are immersed in this stuff 24/7. Mm-hmm. We are seeing these cars long before people see them. We, you know, drive them, experience. We're tired of them by the time they finally arrive in the rest of the country.
Sure.
So we shall see if the MKZ gives Lincoln at least the ability to tread water until they come out with the next gen MKZ.
What do you think of their commercials?
Which ones?
For the MKZ, the Lincoln, kind of that brand.
Well, there's a new wave of them that are just out in the last 3 weeks, I think are very good.
I don't know if I've seen those. The other ones where all of a sudden there's the Abe Lincoln standing in the background, and then there's a stingray that turns into a hawk.
No, it turns into the dash, and then the hawk turns into the headlamps. Whatever.
Those aren't the good ones, though, right?
That's the Fellini version.
Yeah, it should just say, what is that, Feeny at the end?
I've got one more for Jordan. And
that's not American.
And I lost it. Damn, because that was.
Call if you'd like me to roll that.
All right, let's roll that.
Hi guys, this is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. Got a question for Mr. Jordan Lee. With all the different variations in the small block, is there a chance that down the road we might see either a turbo or a twin turbocharged small block? Thank you. Bye.
Well, I obviously
anything's possible.
I can't talk about future product, but
well, could you answer it this way? If you had a turbo on it or a super, well, if you had a turbo on it, is it still, could it still be defined as a small block?
We would never turn our back on any technology. And we did this all new engine and we looked at all sorts of technologies. We weren't wedded to even the pushrod architecture. It just is the right application, the right engine for the car. So we're always looking at new technologies, and if it's applicable, it's the right thing to do, we'll do it.
So what becomes not a small block? What could you have done to this that you couldn't claim this is a small block?
I would have to say nothing. Yeah. I mean, it has a lineage, and attributes change over time. I think it'll always be near and dear to GM, and it'll be a small block, whatever form it takes as it evolves into its next generations. We intend to keep it around a long time.
There you have it, folks. Mr. Jordan Lee has the last word on today's show. He is the Global Chief Engineer and Program Manager for Small Block Engines for GM. Thanks very much, Jordan, for being here.
Thank you. It was a
pleasure. Really appreciate it. And thank you for arranging the logistics to have this beautiful engine here. We always like show and tell on this show, so that's a really good show and tell.
I'm glad you like it. Shout out for Tom Reed. We made sure he got here.
Does it work with half of the pulley there or the crank?
David Kimball drawing. That's our virtual David Kimball. Yeah.
I'd like to thank Scott Burgess from Motor Trend. Scott, it's always good to see you. Garrett Vassalash from Automotive Design Production and Auto Field Guide. Yet another scintillating show. And let's see, as far as seeing our stuff, you can, of course, see all my stuff at AutoExtremist.com. I'm on Twitter, but not on with AutoExtremist. I'm Peter M. DiLorenzo on Twitter. Auto Extremist is on Facebook, although I just do drive-bys there. I never am there. And you can friend Autoline at Facebook.com, Autoline Network, or follow Autoline on Twitter at Twitter.com/Autoline. Gary, where can we find your stuff?
Autofieldguide.com.
Autofieldguide.com. Scott?
Motortrend.com. And on Twitter, Autocritic.
Yes, I see. I follow you on Twitter. And, you know, it was real enjoyable, and we'd like to thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.